Today's Teisho will be on case 2 in the Mu Meng Quan, the U Meng Quan, the gate of no barrier. Case 2, Hyakujo's fox. When Hyakujo Osho delivered a certain series of Teisho, an old man always followed the monks to the main hall and listened to him. When the monks left the hall, the old man would also leave. One day, however, he remained behind, and Hyakujo asked him, "Who are you standing here before me?" The old man replied, "I am not a human being. In the old days of Kashyapa Buddha, I was a head monk living here on this mountain. One day a student asked me, 'Is a man of enlightenment subject to cause and effect or not?' I answered, 'No, he is not.' Since then I have been doomed to undergo 500 rebirths as a fox. I beg you now to give me the turning word to release me from my life as a fox. Tell me, does a man of enlightenment fall under cause and effect or not?" Hyakujo said, "He does not ignore cause and effect." No sooner had the old man heard these words than he was enlightened. Making his bows, he said, "I am now emancipated from my life as a fox. I shall remain on this mountain. I have a favor to ask of you. Would you please bury my body as that of a dead monk?" Hyakujo had the director of the monks strike with the gavel and inform everyone that after the midday meal there would be a funeral service for a dead monk. The monks wondered at this, saying, "Everyone here is in good health. Nobody's in the sick ward. What does this mean?" After the meal, Hyakujo led the monks to the foot of a rock on the far side of the mountain, and with his staff he poked out the dead body of a fox and performed the ceremony of cremation. That evening he ascended the rostrum and told the monks the whole story. Obaku thereupon asked him, "The old man gave the wrong answer and was doomed to be a fox for 500 rebirths. Now suppose he had given the right answer, what would have happened to him then?" Hyakujo said, "You come here to me closer and I'll tell you." Obaku went up to Hyakujo and boxed his ears. Hyakujo clapped his hands with a laugh and said, "I was thinking that the barbarian had a red beard, but now I see before me the red-bearded barbarian himself." Mumon's comment, not falling under cause and effect, how could this make the monk a fox? Not ignoring cause and effect, how could this make the old man emancipated? If you come to understand this, you will realize how old Hyakujo would have enjoyed 500 rebirths as a fox. Mu Meng's verse, not falling, not ignoring, two faces of one die, one dice. Not ignoring, not falling, 1,000 errors, 1,000,000 mistakes. I want to thank everybody for coming this morning. Just so you know that doing Zazen doesn't give you the ability to see into the future. Last night when we were putting out the mats, I said to Kriti, We don't have to put out too many mats because of the 4th of July weekend. I'm sure we won't get that many people. So I'm very glad you all are here on this beautiful, beautiful morning. I hope you had a wonderful sit this morning. In a few days, people will be celebrating Independence Day. Yeah, that's right. But for us, you know, every day we practice is Independence Day. Really. So, happy Independence Day. This koan is about independence, as a matter of fact. Let me just say something, because there are some people here for the first time, about what koans are and how they're employed. Originally, the Buddha, Lord Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, taught meditation practice in a number of ways. But basically, you could say that he taught bhavana, and that bhavana has two hands or two parts. One is samatha, and the other is vipassana. That's the foundation of Buddhist meditation practice. So you might say samatha or shamatha. It could be translated as calming the mind, or stabilizing the mind, or mental tranquility, mental serenity, mental stability. Vipassana could be translated as observing the moment, or watching. Chinese tradition, in Chan tradition and Zen tradition, Chan and Zen mean the same thing. We talk about samatha or shamatha and vipassana as stopping and seeing. So in the Zen tradition, everybody begins with, pretty much I think everybody begins with breath perception meditation. Susokukan is what it's called in Japanese temples. Susokukan, breath perception meditation. And you learn how to sit properly on the cushion. You learn how to breathe through the dantian, the hara. And you watch the breath, and you watch the breath. And this practice combines, in a certain way, samatha and vipassana. Because when you watch the breath, and you learn to breathe regularly, you begin to develop a very stable, calm mind. In fact, it's now the case that some doctors in the United States recommend abdominal breathing for stress. Sometimes if you go to the doctor and say, I'm having trouble with stress, they'll write you a prescription for some mind-altering drug. But if they don't do that, which would be a good thing, they'll say, have you tried abdominal breathing? And abdominal breathing is very effective. It regularizes bodily functions, circulation, heartbeat. Actually, your heart rate drops if you breathe through the abdomen. And mind becomes calm, and stable, centered, you could say. This is really excellent. You know. So this is a version of samatha. At the same time, you're watching the breath. The breath goes out, and the breath goes out. And you can spend a fairly long time just watching the breath. And many changes happen when you're watching the breath. At first, your mind is full of thoughts, very, very shallow thoughts, like, when I finish sitting here today, I have to stop at the grocery store, I'm out of dishwashing liquid, and so on. And then you keep watching the breath, and you begin to have these moments of peaceful openness, where thoughts don't totally disappear, but they recede to the horizon. And you have these moments where the mind's just resting in the present, attentive to the breath. And you can stay there for a little while, and then thoughts come up from deeper parts of your mind. These are not coherent thoughts like I have to go to the grocery store after the sit. They're pieces of thoughts, ancient memories that you haven't remembered for 20 years. So you keep coming back to the breath, and the mind is, you might think of the mind as dropping down, 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 deeper, 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 or your concentration is dropping down, 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 deeper into the mind. And at some point, you begin to notice that the breath disappears. If this hasn't happened to you yet, this will happen. You're watching the breath, and you're watching the breath, and you're trying to get beyond your thoughts. But if you have a stable mind, your mind has entered a state of a samatha, and you're practicing vipassana, awareness of breath. At some point, just automatically, you're watching your breath, and suddenly the breath disappears. And in fact, everything disappears momentarily. It might just be for a split second, like that. But little by little, everything disappears. And this is a first experience of shunyata, of emptiness in the Zen. So you could say that Zen practice involves shamatha and vipassana. But the difference between, one of the big differences between Zen practice and vipassana meditation is that in Zen we direct people's attention to particular aspects of the moment. In some vipassana practice, people do indeed begin with breath perception meditation, but after that, it tends to be simply watching the moment. This is not always true, but in some traditions, it involves simply watching the moment, and you're sort of watching whatever comes to your mind, whatever presents itself to your attention. And sometimes, in some traditions, people label what they see with a word, like a pain, 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 or itching, itching, you know. And in some traditions, people actually say, don't use words, just note, just you're just observing, and you try to just be aware of whatever it is that's happening. So you could say consciousness is sort of drifting through time, and you're practicing, you've done your samatha, your mind is stable and calm, and now you're doing your vipassana. And this is very close to what the Buddha taught. This is like basic Buddhist meditation. It's an excellent practice, wonderful. Zen is just a little different from that in several ways. And one of the ways in which it's different is that it directs your attention to something in particular. So even in Vipassana, sometimes it's the case that a teacher will say something to you, like, I want you to just practice listening this week. You know, you might go to a Vipassana retreat and the teacher say, just listen. Try to listen today. Just hear. Just practice hearing. And that does happen. But in Zen, we direct people's attention in a rather different way. We use what are called koans. Koans. So in order to work with a koan, you have to be able to enter samadhi, or meditative concentration. So you have to be able to go into fairly deep shamatha, a fairly deep samatha. And when you're in that state, the boundary between yourself and the world begins to break down. Not all the time, and not completely, but there's less, the self-awareness disappears, and your awareness of moment is very unified a lot of the time as you're sitting. And this is samadhi. So once you can enter samadhi, and that usually means once you've had your first experience of emptiness, of shunyata, you begin to work with the koans. So the first koan in our tradition is the mu koan. Mu is emptiness itself, focusing on emptiness. Usually it takes people a number of years to have a deep experience of emptiness. Usually people work on it for 3 or 4 years, and then there's another koan, and another koan, and another koan. So it's not so different from Vipassana, actually. Zen is actually, I think, quite close to Vipassana in many ways, although it's a Mahayana, so there's one important difference, in my opinion. My feeling is that the Theravada practice is the earliest Buddhist practice. And around the 10th century, you began to have people who noticed that there was something missing from the model of consciousness in the Theravada tradition. This has changed somewhat, but at the time, there were a number of really great meditation masters who said, you know, we're practicing mindfulness, but a lot of people aren't waking up. And they began to notice that there's something like an unconscious mind or a subconscious mind that gets in the way of mindfulness. See, when we sit on the cushion, we're not always able to just be in the moment because we have karmic obstacles that we carry with us from the past. So these can be fear, envy, greed, lust. You know, when we're kids, we have all gone through experiences of getting, you know, going to school and getting beaten up, or being laughed at, humiliated, punished unfairly, frightened. You know, all of these things live on in our minds, not consciously, but in the unconscious, in the subconscious. So one way to think about the difference between Theravada and Mahayana historically is that the Mahayana masters began to notice, and there were no Mahayana masters at first, they were just Buddhist meditation practitioners, very advanced, and they began to realize, why aren't people waking up? And they began to understand that there's something like an unconscious mind, which we call the storehouse consciousness. This is called the alaya vijnana, the storehouse mind. This is where the karma is kept. If you think of your mind as having many layers, your mind has a topmost layer which says, after the sit, I need to go to the grocery store, right? And then a little deeper, there's a layer that's sort of pieces of thoughts and so on. And then a little deeper, there's a layer that's emotions, feelings, and there's a layer down there which is the storehouse mind. And it's your personal memories, things you've totally forgotten, and other kinds of memories like symbols that come out of your culture. All of these get in the way. Your personal memory, your past experiences get in the way of your being in the moment. And so really that what we call Mahayana really begins with this understanding that there are these unconscious obstacles to mindfulness. Basically this is the difference, I think. Now, you know, many Theravada practitioners today are well aware of this issue. But I think historically, in the development of Buddhism, this is the difference. So anyway, Zen practice practices shamatha and vipassana, but it uses these koans which direct your attention to some aspect of the moment, but they don't do it using the conscious mind. So a Zen teacher won't say, have you noticed that there are spaces between each moment? See, a Zen teacher won't say that. A Zen teacher might say something like, all of the mountains are covered with trees except for one which is bare. Why is this one bare? See? Forces you to work with the deeper part of your mind, kind of intuitive part of your mind. We say in Zen, we call that your big mind. See? Operates on a totally different level from the mind that hears thinks. You know, so if you say, have you noticed that there are spaces between the moments? You may or may not be able to notice that because you might have unconscious obstacles. And also, if somebody tells you that this is true, it might be very hard for you to notice if you're really experiencing it or you're just pretending to experience it or imagining you're experiencing it. So Zen doesn't use kind of direct advice like that. It gives people unconscious cues. And these have to be internalized, and they're processed by the part of the mind that never rises to consciousness. See? So if I say, all of the mountains are covered with trees, why is this one mountain bare? Intellectually, that just sounds like, well, it's bare because there was a fire, or it's bare because it was covered with rocks, you know, or I don't know, how do I know? Well, the discriminating mind can't figure it out, see, at all. And that's the function of the koan, is to say, don't use your intellectual mind, use your deeper unconscious mind. And when you internalize the koan, it goes down, down, down into your mind. Working with koans, it involves being able to enter samadhi, and then when you're in samadhi and the mind is blank because you've entered, you could say, the samadhi of shunyata, the unification with emptiness, then your mind is very open and receptive, and you take the koan in. And usually there's a part of the koan which is called the turning phrase. And you internalize that koan, and it sinks down. It takes a while for it to get down into your unconscious. And then, of course, nothing seems to be happening for a long time, because the little mind, the conscious mind, isn't aware of what's going on in the unconscious mind. It's just not. Basically, your little mind is sitting on the cushion every day saying, why am I not answering my koan? This has been going on for a long time. I'm probably a Zen failure. You know, why did I even go into this? You know, my legs hurt. I'm hungry. You know, blah, blah, blah. You know. Meanwhile, the big mind is working and working and working, see. And your karma begins to float to the surface, right? So while you're sitting one day, you're working on a koan about mountains are covered with trees and this one's bare, and all of a sudden you begin to realize that you had a difficult relationship with your father. You think, what does that have to do with Zen? You see? It may have a lot to do with Zen, because it might be something that's getting in the way of being in the moment. See, the koan's just asking you to notice something about the moment, and it's using a subconscious cue, and all kinds of strange things float to the surface. Now, you know, this is a little different from psychoanalysis, because you don't have to work it through or talk, and whatever you do, don't talk it through. See, we don't do that. Yeah. But when you are sitting on the cushion and you're working on a koan about mountains, and all of a sudden you find that your father hurt your feelings when he punished you unfairly when you were 8 years old, suddenly you're outraged or you're full of pain, or you just keep coming back to the blankness of shunyata, of emptiness, and you keep working with your koan. And little by little, it can take months, can take years, can maybe just take one session, one retreat, but little by little, those karmic obstacles are dissolved, gone. They no longer produce effects in your body and in your mind. See, when Lord Buddha had his Daikensho, his great awakening experience, he said that he had achieved Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. This is like, and he described this as highest awakening. And when he described it, he said, this is awakening without remainder. The Buddha said, this is awakening without remainder. And people read that and think, what's a remainder? It means I have no karmic baggage left in my storehouse mind, basically. I'm completely empty of these obstructions to being in the moment. See, this is the obstacle, this is the objective of Zen practice, is to enter, it's to achieve this state. And so koans are really a crucial part of what we do in Zen. So So it's taken me more than half an hour to explain what koans are. Now I will turn to the koan. And that's better than I've done sometimes. Sometimes I've always had 5 minutes left. This is a story about a great Zen master named Hyakujo, a Baijiang. And he had a student named Obaku, or Wangbo. So the Chinese, this is Baijiang and Wangbo, or the Japanese say Hyakujo and Obaku. So Hyakujo was giving teisho. Every time he'd give teisho, some old man would come in and sit in the back of the room and listen to the talk. And then after the talk, he'd be the first one out, and he'd clear out and be gone. And he wasn't a regular member of the Sangha. So, you know, Hyakujo would give his teisho each time and see this old man come in and think, well, I wonder who that guy is. You know, maybe I'll try to catch him after the teisho and introduce myself. But he'd always be gone, you know. And this went on day after, you know, week after week, week after week. And one day, when the monks left the hall, the old man remained behind. And Hyakujo asked him, "Who are you standing here before me?" The old man said, "I am not a human being. In the old days of Kashapa Buddha, I was the head monk living here on this mountain." You should know that that's a long time ago. In other words, the Buddha of our world age is Shakyamuni, is Siddhartha Gautama. The previous Buddha was a Kashapa Buddha. This long, long ago. Right? This is... So in the days of Kashapa Buddha, a long time ago, I was the head monk living on this temple, on this mountain, this temple. And a student came up to me and said, is an enlightened man or woman subject to cause and effect? In other words, caught up in the world of karma. See, caught up in the world of karma. In other words, is this a person who's free from cause and effect or not? And basically, this head monk said, "Free, totally free." Okay? And as a result of this, he was reborn as a fox and had to live 500 lives as a fox. And he's stuck in these fox reincarnations, see, and he can't get out of it. So he comes up to Hyakujo and he said, where did I go wrong? You know, you've got to help me, get me out of this fox life, you know. So Hyakujo says, well, you know, he or she doesn't ignore cause or effect, is aware of cause or effect, of cause and effect. So the old man hears these words, he goes, you know, if only I, you know, understood that. Thank you. Now I can end this cycle of rebirths and be liberated. Now I'm going to go die. Will you do me a favor? Will you bury me as the monk I once was? And I'll stop there for just a minute. Because this koan is really an important koan. You know, this is the second koan in the Mumonkan for a particular reason. It's right after the Mu Koan, and right after people have had their first experience of emptiness, of first deep, profound encounter with emptiness, they don't always know how to deal with the everyday world, right? This is quite an issue for many people. And so, sometimes people have misunderstandings about this. And also, people who have had their Daikensho experience also sometimes have misunderstandings about their interactions with the everyday world. So when people are confused about the relationship between the deep experience of freedom they have on the cushion. So see, eventually, you know, when you sit, you have these deep experiences of freedom on the cushion. Maybe you had one today. They're just wonderful, aren't they? You know, at first, sitting on the cushion is pretty tough. You sit down and your legs hurt and your back hurts and you're tired, and et cetera, et cetera. You can't focus your mind is buzzing like a beehive, and so on. But eventually, you have these sits where you sit on the cushion and everything disappears, all obstacles disappear, and you're in the moment and you feel connected and your mind is empty, and you hear the birds sing or you feel the beautiful breeze. Watch the leaves. If you're sitting where you can see leaves, you see the leaves blowing in the wind. Everything seems perfect. See, and then you have to get off the cushion and you have to go to your job, right? And it's quite possible for people who have had deep experiences of mushin, of connectedness with the world, with reality, it's possible for people to feel a kind of hesitation or even anger when they have to get off the cushion and go out and deal with the world. Maybe you felt something, maybe anger isn't it, maybe it's just confusion or disappointment. You know, many people have this after sesshin. You know, you go to sesshin and your mind is so still. After 3 days, if you haven't gone to sesshin, all I can say is sign up for August, you know, please. If you want, I'm just kidding. But if you want, you know, it's a great experience. Because, you know, first day is okay. Second day, very tough. Third day, tougher. Okay? So far, I don't sound like I'm really talking you into it. But the thing is, you know, day four and day five, it's like you're on the top of a mountain and you can see in a vista in all directions. And this is commonly so. Ask anybody who's gone. And people come carrying a heavy weight of karma on their shoulders. And when they leave, they feel so much lighter and younger. You know, I do five sesshins a year, and I do at least, I've always done that for 30 years, sometimes seven, sometimes more. And I can't wait, you know, I just look forward to it. Because that sense of, that experience of freedom, this is independence. Right? Real independence. You know, karma remainders are gone, at least temporarily. Right? You have a lot of remainders in there to clean up, but without remainder for a while after a sesshin. And beautiful sense of connectedness with everything. With it, you know, this is the most beautiful path. The Buddha said, this path is beautiful at the beginning, beautiful in the middle, beautiful at the end. And that is so true. You know, this beautiful path. So you go to sesshin and you purify body, heart, and mind, and you have this wonderful experience of independence. And then you get back to your job and it's like, you know, the clock is ticking every second of the day. You know, and you're struggling, it's like trying to swim in a tidal wave, you know. Stress. And you can feel this tremendous sense of outrage. You know, now you know, the thing is, we don't live in an enlightened culture. It's just not. This culture is not enlightened. It's far from it. You know, in the Tang Dynasty in China, people really thought that enlightenment was why we are on this earth. Really, millions of people used to believe that in China. And that's true in Tibet too, you know, in many places. But most people don't think that way in the modern society. They think that we're on this earth to become, you know, fabulously wealthy and so on. And everybody's competing vigorously for wealth, which is, you know, no matter what people say, it's a scarce commodity, right? You know, there's the constant tension and stress, and nothing in our culture encourages you to wake up. So it's possible to have this very wide gap between the experience of freedom you achieve on the cushion and the sense of confinement as you go through your daily life. And some people use Zen practice to create a kind of like escapist attitude, or they use Zen practice because of their Zen practice. They begin to develop a kind of I don't know what how to put it, anger or fear or outrage or aversion. It's like, you know, if you go into the refrigerator and you're looking for something, and if you don't always keep up on your refrigerator, you know, you say, what's this in the back of the refrigerator? You know, and you reach in and you pull out that plastic container. You think, what is this, you know? And then you open it up, it's like, oh, ugh, you know. This was from, you know, Winter Sashin, you know. Oops, you know. That's aversion, right? Ugh, right? Ugh. So you develop a kind of aversion, right, to the world. And people can, you know, people sometimes, you know, you'd be shocked at how many people say, you know, Zen has really liberated me, but you know, when I'm back with my family or back in my my job or whatever, I just I'm not sure I feel better, you know. And so, you know, when people sometimes people use Zen to run away from life. This happens, you know. So, for example, a number of years ago, I ran into a person who only practiced here very briefly. And he was a PhD in sociology at Princeton. And he was coming to the Princeton group when we were sitting near the university, right outside the in a building right near the university. And he really threw himself into Zen. And then all of a sudden he came to see me, and he said, "I said, well, how's it going?" And he said, "Well, good, but I'm quitting. I'm dropping out of the PhD program in sociology. I'm going to go live in Montana and throw pots." Now, let me just say, there's nothing wrong with, if your passion is ceramics, go for it. You know, go for it. Don't let anybody stand in your way. If your heart says, you know, I want to make the most beautiful ceramics in the world, great. You know, my personal feeling is you shouldn't let anybody discourage you. If you're sitting on the cushion and you know, part of you says, I am, clay is my life, right? I love clay. I love to throw ceramics. That would be great. So I'm not saying it's a mistake to quit the PhD program at Princeton and become a ceramicist. Not at all. But I asked him, I said, well, have you, so you're really into ceramics, yes? And he said, I've never done it. So then I thought, now, uh-oh, this is a problem, see? Because, you know, basically, why not study ceramics in Princeton, you know? You could take Saturday afternoon and go over and learn ceramics before you quit everything and throw it all out the window and, you know. But no, I have to leave. I'm going to Montana to study ceramics, right? So this is, you know, in my humble opinion, this person was using Zen, which he had only just started to practice and had not yet entered samadhi at all. He was using Zen to run away from life, see? And in Zen practice, this is called fox Zen. Fox Zen, see? It's like saying, oh no, I don't have to deal with this troubled world because I'm a Zen student. Right. See. So that's called fox Zen. And we all have our moments of fox Zen, but it's very important to, you know, the more you practice, for a long time in your practice, you are going to feel a gap between your life, your daily life, and the Sesshin experience. Right, it's going to happen, and you're going to feel a gap between how you experience reality on the cushion and how you experience reality off the cushion. But my advice is that if you're troubled by your experience off the cushion, you know, keep sitting first of all, and actually try to sit more, you know. If you're sitting once a week and you're feeling that you're overwhelmed by your life circumstances, please start sitting every day. You know, I mean, for me, when I did Zen, when I was doing Zen practice, I had a clear motive: terror, right? Sheer terror. The stress of my life. I mean, some people can take a lot of stress and some people can't. I don't think I'm that good with stress, or was, because I was so stressed out and so frightened that when I started doing Zen, it was like a life raft, right? It was like a life preserver, right, in the ocean. And I grabbed onto Zen and it saved my life. You know? So all I can say is grab onto Zen and let it save your life. Just sit, get up every morning and say, well, I'm tired. If you're being driven nuts by your life circumstances, get up and sit, right? It's crucial. Most problems, you know, in life can be solved by more sitting. I swear that's true. I deeply believe that. That and exercise, right? And and a vegetarian diet, right? But most problems can be solved by sitting. I swear that's true. And that's why we're here, right? That's what the Buddha said. You know, basically, you're having a lot of stress, more zazen, more zazen. And it will help. You'll be calmer. Even though you might take up time, precious time sitting, you will be more effective if you're not terrified and stressed out, yes? Okay. But on the other hand, as you go through your day, it's possible to have a negative mindset or a positive mindset. See, one way to look at all the things that happen to us as we go through the day is to say, if we're Zen practitioners, is to say, all of this is getting in the way of my enlightenment. See, it's possible to be sitting in your office and you have a 2 o'clock deadline. And the boss is not a nice guy, right? Not that that ever happens, you know, but and you sit there and you think, if only I were on the mountaintop with the monks, you know, it would all be so peaceful. You know? I hate this job. This is all getting in the way of my enlightenment, see? See, now, if you do that, you're creating a karmic obstacle. Every time you think that way, you're creating a karmic obstacle. I admit that our culture is insane. I admit. But the job of a Zen practitioner is to turn poison into pure water, right? And the way we do that is with mu shin. Mu takes poison and turns it into beautiful mountain water that we can all drink safely. And it's delicious. So that's what our practice does. When you're going through your day, get up and sit. Crucial. But then as you go through your day, you know, try thinking this. And this is the truth, so help me. You know, everything that's happening to you is helping you to wake up. That's what the Buddha taught. And the more you practice, the more clear it is that this is so. If right now you're somewhat skeptical, just try it. Just try it. You know, there was a wonderful Zen master named Jiyu Kennett. Jiyu Kennett was one of the first women in the Church of England. She was British. She was one of the first women in the Church of England to be ordained as a priest in the Church of England. And she became ordained, and then she was not very happy with her spiritual practice. So she read some books about Zen, and she decided to go to Japan. Yeah. And she went to Japan and started training at a Soto temple in Japan with a very progressive teacher. And it was revolutionary because she was the only Westerner in the temple, but she was also the only woman in the temple. And you might think that Zen temples are filled with wonderful people, but this isn't so. Zen temples are filled with the people who are have all the human failings you can imagine, including jealousy and fear. And so many of the monks were terribly threatened by this woman, you know, in the temple. And they were terribly threatened by this Westerner in the temple. And so they constantly messed her up. So for example, you know, when she was a unsui, a beginner, a novice, she would ask for instructions and people would give her the wrong instructions. So, you know, she might say to somebody, well, when do we wake up? And they would say, oh, don't worry, I'll come and get you, right? Nobody would come and get her. So she races into the Zendo late for sutras, right? And the Jikijitsu, the temple head, sees her and scowls, late. Or she'd say, how do we rake the gravel? Oh, like this, right? She'd rake it all and it'd be wrong. She'd get scolded by, and this went on and on. People were constantly, being mean to her and nasty to her. And she could have, you know, she just sat, and one day she was at the edge of despair and she went in to see the Roshi, the teacher, the sensei. And she said, listen, you know, everybody's being mean to me and nobody's helping me and they're actually deceiving me. And the teacher, the Roshi, said, everything that's happening to you is helping you to wake up. And this was like a magic jewel. You know, in the Indian Buddhism, there's this idea of the wish-fulfilling gem. It's like you're digging through the dirt and you find a gem, and if you just hold the gem in your hand, it grants your wishes, right? You know, Zazen is wish-fulfilling gem. And so is this. You know, everything is Buddha. Everything is Buddha. Another way to put it is, everything that's happening to me is helping me to wake up. Everything that's happening to me is helping to wake up. So all day long what you're doing is you're going through these obstacles are like food that you're going to turn into enlightened mind. You know, it's one way to think about Zen is we go through the day and we get through it and we sit on the cushion and we try to clean up all this negative energy, all this karma that's in our way. That's true in a certain way. But it's also true to say that, you know, we sit on the cushion and this is like our fuel. This is like our rice. And we process all this rice and turn it into enlightened mind. See, you've got to have some fuel to make the car go. You've got to have some fuel, right, to build the fire. So you need it. You need it. And the worse it is, in a way, the brighter your mind can become. This is absolutely true. The bigger the challenge, the bigger the awakening. This is absolutely so. See. So anyway, this is, the Fox Zen says, you know, this life stinks. I wish I were back on my cushion, blah, blah, blah. There's another way to practice, see. Another way to practice. It's like everything is my rice. Everything is helping me to wake up. Everything is my food. So you just get, wake up, you sit on the cushion, you have your sit, and it's like, okay, you know, whatever is happening today is Buddha. Whatever is happening today is, and you go ahead and say it to yourself. You know, go through the day. When the boss yells at you, come, go out to the bathroom and sit there and just say, Buddha, 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 Buddha. And then, you know, next morning, get on the cushion again. But I swear to you, I, you know, I really believe in being totally straight, you know. If you come into Dokusan, I never say anything that I don't think is absolutely true. So if you're making progress with your koan, I would never say, oh, you're far off base. I try never to play those kinds of games. I really don't approve of those. And I'm telling you the truth. The more you sit, the clearer it is that I can tell you everything that has happened to me in my life, including the most painful things, were helping me to wake up. This is all food, all rice. If you sit on the cushion, go through your day, every day is your Independence Day. Every day is your Independence Day.